You want to turn that over, or have you turned?
Yeah, it's on a new tape now.
Okay.
The date is February the 19th, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Reg Lane by Dr. R.H. Roy at the University of Victoria. One or two things I was going to ask you about, Reg. You were talking about your own difficulty, shall we say, finding a house, all that sort of thing. The Canadian group down there, I gather, what, 200 and some all
oh,
told?
No. Oh, not no, hell thing. No. There may have been way back in the original days, but we had about 90 people down there, which included, perhaps 15 to 20 bandsmen in the NORAD band. So you lop those off and you get down to... Oh, no, we were a very small group in NORAD headquarters. Yeah. But we had a lot of important positions. There were nearly all officers. There were very, very few. Well, the only airmen, I suppose, were a couple of drivers. And that's about it, plus the bandsmen. The rest were all officers and went from a three-star general... down through a major general, one air commodore or one brigadier general. We must have had four or five colonels, and then a whole slew of half colonels, and then the rest would be majors. And except for the deputy, at least the deputy band leader, who was a captain. I don't think we had a captain on the staff. They were all majors and up. So the net result was that it was a fairly effective group of people, all very carefully selected, and I'll get into that and at least make reference to it in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
In a little while.
Well, I was wondering actually about barracks for Canadians.
No, everybody was on their own. For example, my driver, who was a corporal, a lad who had been with me in the Air Division, as a matter of fact. When I went down to NORAD, he wrote to me. And he was then still a driver, and he wrote to me and said, have you got a driver down there? And I said, of course, I immediately wrote to him, or phoned him, actually, and I said, are you interested? And he said, I certainly am. So, of course, I immediately went to Ottawa and said, the driver I would like to have down at NORAD is my old driver that I had in Europe. And a fabulous driver, and just a superb, and a very fine lad, too. Great sense of humor, but aside from being a very, very good driver, as an aside, he was the only one my wife could fall asleep in the car if he was driving. If I was driving or anyone else was driving, she would never fall asleep. But with this young lad, and in Europe we did it several times, long haul, coming back, say, from Frankfurt or Stuttgart fairly late at night. He'd had a full day, and we're now talking about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and we'd started out, say, at 8 or 9 in the morning. And Barbara would fall asleep in the back seat.
Yeah.
I couldn't, but he would. She would.
Yeah.
Because she had absolute, complete, utter confidence in that boy's driving. And it didn't make a difference whether he'd been up 24 hours or not.
Okay.
He was a superb
driver. What was his name?
It'll come to me in a second here. I'm just trying to think of it. Ron Savoy. He was from Moncton. One of the... French-speaking lads from New Brunswick. What do they call themselves?
Acadian.
He was an Acadian.
Yeah.
And a terrific sense of humor, but a very capable driver. And also, never once did he let me down in any way.
Would he be your batman?
No.
As well?
Well, as it turned out, he kind of doubled a wee bit in brass. The batman idea went out the window sometime, I suppose in the late 50s, the idea of batman went out completely. But what I did do, of course, as he was my driver, I used him when we were entertaining and so forth. He was in the house and acted as the barman and would help serve drinks he would do any odd job that was required, whether it was a question of suddenly trying to get a load of wood for the open fireplace, which was very difficult to get in a country where there's very little wood or trees.
Yeah.
Cutting the grass, whatever. If I wasn't available or couldn't do it myself, he kind of filled in and did it very, very willingly, with a laugh. He was, and then he married a very charming girl as well. while in Europe. So, yeah. Of course, the whole family came down, and I still correspond with them.
Oh, well.
And they're back in Europe again now.
Yeah.
Ron made sergeant, and I got him up to sergeant. Then, I guess it was Dave Adamson who recommended him for commission. I was always a little leery about putting Ron up for a commission. His educational level was fairly low, and he would have gone on and could have made warrant officer and so forth. He was a good little organizer, but I really didn't feel he was officer material as such. But anyway, he was put up and passed the initial screening and began officer school and got about halfway through officer school and said, "To hell with it, this is not for me. Not me."
Yeah.
And it wasn't.
Yeah.
So he then dropped out,
yeah.
And of course reverted back to being a sergeant, and is still a sergeant.
Bless my soul.
I'm sorry he went through that. I haven't seen Ron since, although I've corresponded with him, but I haven't seen him since dropping out. And I just hope and pray that it hasn't had some kind of adverse effect on his personality, because there was no happier person on the face of this earth than that lad. And whenever things got tough in the office. And there were times when things were very tight in the office. It didn't make any difference whether it was in Europe or even down at NORAD. He spent quite a bit of time in the office, always coming in to see if there was anything to be done or any messages to be run, whatever. He was that kind of person. Yeah. And every come in, he could almost sense the tension. And he would come out with some kind of remark, and the whole place would break down. And I could hear them out in the office, my EA and my secretary and whoever else might be there, just laughing like crazy. And of course I knew immediately what had happened, so I'd go out and find out, and of course it was wrong.
That
type. And he was that kind, just a great asset. I'm spending some time on this lad because he played such a part and was so close to us. In Europe, for example, I had a very good secretary too, a girl by the name of Jill Sharp. She was for a corporal at that time and is now commissioned. Now this is a different story in terms of commissioning. This gal was extremely capable. She was the finest secretary that I've ever known. Just superb. If I had to give a talk or something like that, I would call Jill in, and I would dictate, and I would talk as fast as I can. I would just pour out. And Jill would never hiccup. And I would do that, say, for 45 minutes.
Boy.
And I'd say, "All right, Jill." Well, she would take that back, and literally within a matter of a very short period of time, the same day, would come back with a fairly well-edited paper of what I had done. And then, of course, I had something to start editing and cutting back, because I might even have an hour.
Yeah.
Damn it. I might have even had an hour and a quarter. What I was really looking for was 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get it all out, and then I could start to edit out what I felt was not necessary. And it was on a very important briefing, such as a report back to Ottawa, and a verbal briefing to the Council of Ottawa. I remember one time I got up to draft 19, and Jill was just about ready to have a fit. But great gal. Well, she was... great girl, and Ron was in the office as well. And little things, like a birthday. If it was one of the immediate staff's birthday, like the chief of staff or his driver or one of the secretary or even my wife's, Jill would bake a cake, and Ron would bring in a couple of bottles of wine.
Yeah.
And we'd normally knock off about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, starting about 7:45 in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. And they'd come in with these, and they'd say, "Could we have a birthday party?" And of course, come into the office with the cake and the wine, and would have already, say, contacted Barbara. Barbara would have come over. Little things like, little touches like that were just magnificent. And so I was delighted to have Ron as a driver down in NORAD, and he continued in exactly the same way, and very, very fine people. I've been blessed, I suppose, through my career with some excellent immediate staff. Superb people. Gosh, while I'm on staff, I might as well even mention Gus Cloutier, who was my executive assistant at that time in Europe. Cloutier, C-L-O-U-T-I-E-R, Cloutier, Gus Cloutier. Gus now became, after he left Europe, he came back to Ottawa into a staff job then became EA to the Minister of National Defense and went through some six ministers, and is now the Sergeant-at-Arms in the House of Commons.
Oh,
now, very capable lad, a lad who was that, to me, the epitome of a good EA is the one who is one jump ahead of you all the time, but does not usurp your authority.
Mm.
And Gus used to do that to perfection. I could relate dozens of cases of, I'd call Gus in and say, Gus, I think we'd better do this. And he'd say, it's already done. He would have already anticipated, would already, whether it was a question of getting ready for a departure, getting airline tickets to go back to Canada, or he would, of course, knew exactly what was going on all the time.
Yeah.
And I suppose learned very quickly how I thought, and therefore would anticipate everything.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about policy or anything like that, just the things of making the office move smoothly and quickly. And so I came to rely on him enormously over the years. And of course, no wonder he went on, and he handled six ministers, if you will, as executive assistant, and not one of them fired him. So he left of his own accord and became Sergeant of Arms in the House of Commons. Anyway, that I've had, as I say, over the right through. I've been very, very fortunate.
Well, now, what about problems with Canadians? Now, you're a senior officer down there, and it, you know, shows that you have 100 Canadians. Presumably there's bound to be some...
We had some sticky problems. There was a very small, I'm sorry, there were a few more airmen. We had a very small orderly room, and I think we had, a sergeant and a corporal in the orderly room. Mm-hmm. And it was a major who was a CO of the administrative unit, and it was, they kept the administration of all the Canadians going, and would handle all the normal correspondence coming in on the Canadian net from Ottawa, because it was a unit, an overseas unit, if you will. And so the flow of information was coming in, and they would sort it out. Some of it was applicable to NORAD, some of it wasn't. What was applicable, they would then pass on up to me if they thought it was necessary. And I also then had appointed one of the colonels as a CO to handle any matters that might come up. At a CO's level, a CO of the total organization. And then if it was a very serious matter, then of course he would refer it to me as the senior Canadian. Now, we did have problems. And they had to be handled on a Canadian net. There were the usual type of problems that any CO would run into. Problems, personnel problems, family problems. And we had our share of them. We had one case, an officer's wife was a woman who just simply couldn't stop spending money. And she ran up debts all over the state of Colorado. And it was difficult getting that straightened out. It took time because she was had run him into debt to the tune of thousands and thousands of dollars. And so, but it was finally sorted out. We got her. We got him back, to Canada. But it was in a way where he had arranged that, and all his creditors accepted the position where he would gradually be paid. And to my knowledge, he has. Because he was not like her. He was very upset with this and threatening divorce. Well, the usual infighting that you can imagine in the family. But he himself was determined that he was going to pay these things back one way or the other. And I assume that he has. Oh, there were all the other usual problems. We had the odd case of alcoholism and so forth. Mostly, that type of problem you handled in the only way you could handle, which was to get them transferred back to Canada, because these were representative positions. The screening machine missed these people in the screening. They should never have gone down, but they did. Therefore, the easiest way to handle it was to send them back to Canada and have a replacement come down. Discipline was never a problem. I didn't have to handle one single disciplinary case the whole time I was down there. Everybody wanted to be there to begin with. It was a good posting. Good posting. It was interesting. It was good. They liked the environment. So no one wanted to do anything which would queer their pitch so that they would be returned back home. And so discipline was not a problem at all. And we used to have our parties. We used to have a Christmas party, then a spring party. And the Christmas party, it was the usual taking over one of the restaurants and having a dinner and a band and so forth. And we paid for that primarily out of the profit that was being made from our small PX, primarily liquor, because liquor we had down there at duty-free.
Did you?
But we would put, I think we put an assessment of 35 or 50 cents a bottle, which went into the kitty for our non-public funds fund.
Yeah. Right.
And then at Christmas time, that fund would pay the majority of the cost, or the large portion of the cost of a Christmas party. But at those Christmas parties, it was great fun. Mm-hmm. It gave me a chance, those gatherings gave me a chance to talk to all of the lads, because I would never see, most of them I didn't see from one day to the next. And sit down at the table, and even if it was only for 5 or 10 minutes, and you could immediately get a sense of feeling whether they were happy, anything that was bugging them, and so forth. And in that way, I kept in touch, if you will, with the people we had down there. And I can't remember any instance of something coming up through that that would require action on my part. The requirements of a CO, if I can put it that way, for the normal administration of a unit was very small indeed. And incidents were very rare. I'm giving you probably the only ones I really can remember over 2 years.
Yeah, in nothing major.
Nothing major.
Theft or murder.
No, nothing like that. Not like we had in the Air Division, where we had... And I think that's probably on tape, but the instances in of serious, I won't call it crime, because some of them were just civil law, such as car accidents and people being knocked down and killed. I have recounted that,
yes,
so
I won't
repeat myself. Yeah. No, nothing like that.
Yeah.
And then the paperwork... Anything that Ottawa required would come up, and then we would set the machine in motion. And sometimes there was a requirement for a paper to be prepared. Well, I would call in one of the officers, depending on what the requirement was. And I would give him the task of doing this paper, or a little review or a study, whatever it was that Ottawa wanted, as an add-on to his job. And we may have had no bearing whatsoever to the job he was doing in NORAD. It was just that I felt he was the one who probably had some background in that particular field and would be the best one to put on paper and gather some thoughts that I could then circulate around to a few of the senior staff and get a Canadian position, and then I would sign off on it and send it back to Ottawa.
Yeah.
But I'm now talking about purely national matters, not necessarily relating to related to NORAD in any way.
If you had an occasion to talk to Ottawa, say you wanted to say something to Ottawa privately, could you do it?
Well, it all depends on what you mean privately. If you mean on a secure line,
Something that you, as a Canadian commander, wanted to speak to with the minister in Ottawa.
No, not if on a, if it was very confidential. The answer was no. Not that the lines were bugged, or anything like that. The phone lines weren't bugged. But if you're differentiating here between us, let me put it this way. We did not have secure lines, and therefore, not like we even had in the war, where they had the scrambler system, which was supposedly a secure line. No, there were no secure lines. Therefore, if there was anything, you daren't put anything that was of a classified nature over that phone. You either had to send it by wire, or in code, or in a classified letter, which would then be handled as all classified letters are in a special way. And of course, the last one, if it was really required, was of course a quick trip up to Ottawa and do it that way.
Yeah.
So matters of a confidential nature. Now, if we're dealing with personnel matters or something like that of a confidential nature, nothing operational. Then I wouldn't hesitate to use the phone and discuss it over the phone. But I used to always back up anything like that on paper with a letter or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But again, very rare, very, very rarely did that happen. Yeah. Again, I think it's indicative of the caliber of people we had. They were all extremely good people.
Incidentally, now, this brings out a minor point. Your immediate boss, of course, would be the Commander-in-Chief.
That's right. That's
who was your immediate... Who did you report to in Ottawa?
The CDS. The chief.
Oh, I see.
The chief.
The chief of the defense staff.
That's right. That's right. He was my immediate superior in Ottawa.
Yeah. Who was he at that time?
Let's see, I guess the JADEX was in the chair when I went down, I guess it would be. So JADEX would have been the General Dextrous. General Dextrous would have been the CDS the whole time I was at NORAD.
Mm.
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I just wondered, I was hesitating because to make sure that there wasn't any his predecessor, but I'm pretty sure JADEX was in the chair when I went down.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay, now let's get on to the part you were going
well,
to talk
all right,
about
now,
relations with Ottawa.
On that previous, tape a little while ago, I made reference to the situation in Ottawa when we were talking about communications and exercises, and the operations side of NORAD. Everything I've said about reaction, communication system, is really all in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We did have lines to Ottawa. But Ottawa really was the complete reverse of the situation in the United States. In the United States, the forces, whether they be air, sea, or land, and particularly in Washington at the chief of staff level, carrying the responsibility they do of the deterrent and everything else, left no stone unturned to make sure that any required information got through it quickly and immediately. Ottawa took a very different attitude. Ottawa, having no overriding responsibility, having no bomber or missile force, and only being involved in the air defense, the bomber defense aspect of NORAD, not the space or missile defense, tended to leave everything to NORAD, so to speak, until something happened. And then as soon as something happened which Ottawa politically didn't like, then all hell would break out. And questions would be asked in the House, and the minister would be buzzing around trying to get answers. Such things as the occasion when the situation in the Middle East deteriorated very rapidly, and it looked as if the USSR were going to bring, it was in Lebanon, they were going to mount, they actually were loading a paradivision, and it looked as if they may be actually going to move into the Middle East, to the point where the United States declared unilaterally, increased the state of readiness of all of their forces, went up to a DEFCON 3. Well, that order which came out from Washington naturally hit NORAD, and it was just a Canadian, the duty controller that particular moment happened to be a Canadian colonel on duty in the ops room, and in accordance with all the procedures laid down, he immediately transcribed that in the proper fashion out to all of the units, which included the units in Canada as well as those in the United States. Then, of course, NORAD was formed. Well, that the system worked the way it was meant to work. But politically, of course, there had been no discussion between Ottawa and Washington before the United States unilaterally, to all of their commands, pushed out this DEFCON 3 alert. Well, the politicians got hold of that, and naturally away they ran with it, and raised Cain about Canada bringing forces up to a state of alert without government authority and all that kind of nonsense. And although the agreement between Canada and the United States more or less made provision for that kind of a situation, it really was meant to be an air defense situation, and this was not. This was just another simple matter of increasing the state of readiness of the United States forces. And Washington did it without really thinking that in going out to NORAD, obviously it would imply and would include some Canadian units, and it was done as a, without any malice. It was just done without realizing that the chain that would be put into action, as far as NORAD is concerned. Well, the outcome of that, of course, was that after an awful lot of comment from the opposition, that something would be done to try and overcome this. Well, it was already in the agreement, the clause that talks about discussion, that there will be continuing discussion between Ottawa and Washington. And basically that was meant that if in the state, in the event of something happening, that Washington, before taking any action, would discuss it with Ottawa. And conversely, although the chances that happened were pretty remote, in this case, they didn't. And I suppose to that extent, they were at fault. But again, the Americans really only meant to put their own forces on alert, and someone up the line didn't think or forgot that in triggering NORAD, they were triggering Canadian forces as well. If they had gone out on the pure American net, which would have been to the American Air Defense Command, it would have been fine. Only American defense units would have been brought up to a higher state of alert. But operationally, that had never been written in, because that's like bringing half of the bloody organization up to a state of alert, and the rest is sitting on its bum, and yet it's a fully integrated organization. Right. And operationally, the whole thing should be up at a higher state if one part should be there. So, to that extent, there was the Americans were at fault. As a sequel to that, the next conference of the commanders in Ottawa, I tabled this because I felt that what applied to NORAD might also someday apply to SACLAND, or even in NORAD in NATO. There's something like that could happen, and therefore it was terribly important that the commander in the field, the Canadian commander in the field, have pretty clear direction from the chief on what he was to do. And if I could go back to the NORAD situation, what was the deputy commander to do in that case? Brief all his Canadians that if something happened on the American net, they weren't to take any damn action until they'd cleared it with me, and I would then go and phone Ottawa and clear it with Ottawa before we did it. Well, you can see what would happen in an integrated organization, as in that case, where the duty controller was a Canadian. And if he suddenly said, well, I better not action this thing from Washington until I clear it with the deputy commander. Well, of course, the whole damn thing would come collapsing down very rapidly and could lead to very serious consequences. Well, to cut a long story short, the chief directed that if anything like that happened again, in an integrated organization as we were, that the Canadians would act on the operational directive as it was received, and then bring Ottawa into the picture. And then if Ottawa was going to argue the case, then Ottawa would have to tell Washington that they would have 48 hours to replace all the Canadians with their own people. Yeah. This is like recalling an ambassador. It means that you just don't believe in the whole bloody system to begin with. But the key point was made that, yes, as the colonel had done in this case, act on the operational side. And then we'll worry about the politics later if it becomes a political issue. Well, having said that, that kind of sets the stage for why did that sort of thing happen. Now, I've mentioned that the states had all the various communications in the system ready for instant action, instant conferencing, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ottawa, they didn't. I've got to paint one more picture so that you can clear it and so people understand or you understand. We had all these various means of detection, warning systems that would tell us instantaneously of something happening. That whole system was partially repeated in SAC, and it was definitely repeated in the war room in Washington. Now, they just got the readouts. They didn't get all the discussion that was going on behind that readout, what it was. Was it a false alarm? Was there something going wrong in the system that would have triggered an alarm? That kind of thing would be going on at North. All that SAC would get and all that Washington, the ops room in Washington get would be the indicators on the board, an alert of some kind or another within the NORAD system. An indication that something was happening. Well, having got that, of course, they would be immediately alerted. And so as soon as the red phone was picked up or a conference net was set up with SAC and Washington, they would already be up to speed in what had happened. So there was no need to go back and repeat and say, well, now here's what's happened in the last 3 or 4 minutes. They knew.
Yeah.
They were alerted. So it was then just a simple matter of picking up and saying whatever it was. Let's take the simpler case. This is a non-alert. We have uncovered a technical fault in one of the computers, or there's been a misreadout at one of the stations, which has given us a false alert, and therefore this whole thing is over. With that, then everybody went back to normal and mm-hmm. thing over.
Yeah.
If it was, it may have been an alert caused by a launching of a test satellite, of a test missile.
Mm-hmm.
From one of the test ranges in the USSR, which would cause an alert. We would pick that up immediately, and it would ring up in the ops room. Well, in that case, then we would then get on to Washington and SAC and say, it is a single launch, and give them the background of what it was, where it was going, because we knew, we knew the flight path of the missile and so forth, and we could tell them where it was and that it was a test flight and the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but the kicker in that, and the important point, is that they were already alerted, and we didn't have to spend any time bringing them up to speed. We could just tell them what had happened, or an explanation, if you will. Well, Ottawa didn't have anything like that. Not a thing. All Ottawa got, there's one other bit I've got to explain. There used to be, for record purposes, a hard copy readout which would go out over the teletype of anything like that happened in the system. But it would have to be coded. First it had to be written, gotten onto a teletype, and coded, and then decoded, and then put into somebody's hand at the other end in the form of a teletype message. That was the way that Ottawa found out that something was happening. But, of course, the time delay, we're now talking in terms of even an operational immediate, we're talking in terms of a 25 to 30-minute delay from the time that that thing gets onto the wires, coded, gets decoded, gets picked, torn off, and handed to somebody, and they read the darn thing. So what happened invariably was that Ottawa, because they did not have this kind of a system, and it was the only real fast means was to pick up a phone and talk to them into the ops room in Ottawa, in National Defense Headquarters ops room. They were always way behind real time. And it used to be an absolute bind, if something happened, of letting them know, or they would get the hard copy.